The purpose of the elections, I think, is to discuss the theory and decomposition of the particle here in sheep and the modulus back of formal groups and what that has to do with stable homotopy theory. In particular, the algebraic analog of the chromatic convergence of fracture squares. But I can't just start there. there really isn't any idea what I'm talking about. So subject to your approval and your input, I thought I would start actually with discussing what a formal group actually is and what the modulus stack actually is, and then that would be today. And then in the later lectures, coming to terms with the actual geometry of this thing, and then putting that together and telling you the decomposition theorem by logical and achieved. What this has to do with homotopy theory is that, so this, well, that's the title of the whole lecture series. So the vision here begins with Krillin and Marama. In fact, I think Krillin went to a lecture on formal groups in Montreal in the late 60s, and nothing was the same after that. I think it was just a weekend, but he came back and all of homotopy theory was changed. So this goes back to the early 70s or so. And the observation based on these guys is that, so just to put it in modern language, that certain very important homology theories are in one-to-one correspondence with affine maps of this form, the modulus of this column thing, something flat maps of this form. And that, say, mu star mu comma. So that's something that comes from complex coordination. These are one-to-one correspondence with quasi-coherent sheaves, which are quasi-coherent sheaves. Over. Now, I'm going to explain what these terms mean, but this is the origin of this. And then, for example, just to give you an example of the Adams-Novikov spectral sequence, which is our most sensitive algebraic approximation of the homotopy group of spheres, reads something like this. So if you're Adams, this is what it would look like. But you can rewrite this thing as the coherent cohomology of the modulus stack of formal groups with there's this funny T over 2 here, which this is the coherent cohomology of this stack with coefficients in some sheaf, which I'll explain about later. This is the sheaf of invariant differentials. So Marama's picture. And there's this document that Marama wrote, which people like Haynes Miller have seen, which I think contains everything I'm going to tell you this week. and this was like the early 70s to mid 70s. And so Marama vision from this point produced the what is known as the chromatic picture of stable homotopy. Which, roughly speaking, takes the geometry of this guy
turns that into a decomposition of the same home tires. And then, of course, there's the famous papers of Miller, Avenel, and Wilson. I think these guys used Murat as much as a... This is an L. Which uses this, without ever talking about this spec, tears apart this algebra to do some very elaborate calculations. This document of Murat, if anybody ever sees one, let me know. If you see a copy on eBay or something. Okay, so that's why I care, but as I said, the plan is to, at least the medium term goal is to actually explain this and to talk about where this chromatic crystal comes from by using the theory of these quasi interactions. All right, today I want to tell you what a formal group is. Let's put that very easy, boys.
They should have a black or a white or a German or something.
The sliding thing to cover things, or is it better just to work back and forth? I'm going to treat this as an actual class. So let me begin. I actually have no idea who the audience is. Throughout this whole thing, I'm going to end up using the FPQC topology, which is probably not familiar to home. So let me tell you a little bit about that. And for those of you who know what this is, just check your ears. So the scheme X is quasi, from now on quasi will be abbreviated Q because it gets used all the time, compact. So QC, if and only if it's compact in the sense of topology, every open cover is a finite subcover. Affine scheme, certainly satisfied this. And then homomorphism, so this is what gets used all the time, homomorphism F from X to Y of schemes is quasi compact if for all opens U in Y to pull that. Let's see, what's the other thing? What's the low zone here on board? I'm already past that. I want to make a point here with these things, so let me get to that. XS is one of these words that only are themselves separated. If and only if the diagonal is quasi compact. And, well, I won't define this at the moment. What's the point of having all this? If I have a morphism X to S, which is quasi compact and quasi separated. And the push forward by a couple of quasi coherent sheaves. It's quasi. now we have to discuss this. Should I define project overage?
Not the union, though.
Or again, is anybody willing to be embarrassed and say anything? What's that?
Yes.
Good. So, the sheep, so we've established, so sheep OX, the little X model, kind of scheme X, is quasi compact. Who started this quasi business?
What's that?
The G person. The G person. We must have had something. Was it like if you're putting the steering, you're allowed to drop all the quasis? Is that something? If for all opens, G containing U contains X, these are all open. I love the zone here.
I think that in French, compact means separated, and in English, there's a difference. Quasi-compact means that you lift the separation condition.
So he was fighting American culture.
Yes, exactly. Right. Because in English, compact doesn't imply separated, right? Uh-huh. And so there's a difference between the two.
Well, we're stuck with it as long.
Yeah.
What's that? It's becoming French culture. So let's see, I've got F of D, I've got F of U. So let's say this thing is an OXU model, so I can do this. D, I can tensor it up, and I've got a map like this, and I demand it up. So this is the natural extension of the theory of model. If X is affine, then quasi-coherent sheaves. The category of quasi-coherent sheaves is equivalent to a model. And the equivalent this way just sends F to its global section. So these hypotheses keep coming up because of this fact. Normally the push forward of a quasi-coherent sheaf is not necessarily quasi-coherent. So now, once and for all, let's record what the FTQC topology is. Why am I using this one? Well, because sooner or later I'm going to write down the Lagarde ring, which is not the Noetherian. So we need a fat topology. So I have to tell you what the opens are and the covers. Opens are which are quasi-compact and flat. And I bet you can now guess what a cover is. Should be quasi-compact, flat, and surjective. And that's the thing that we state. Flat and surjective is the same state. All right. This is the. I always get the words in the wrong order. This is either the coarsest or the finest topology in which, or one of the, that we consider in which representables are schemes, or sheaves, axes. And don't draw out of schemes over half axes. Never have to repeat these words. Well, now I want to tell you what a Houston has had no name on it. Here's a word I can't spell for sure. Why am I doing this? Normally people define formal group in these lectures as something which is locally like a formal group law. And it's not evident from that description that a formal group satisfies the properties of being effective descent, for example. It becomes complicated from that point of view. Well, I'd like to give a global definition of a formal group which specializes to that kind of condition, and then obviously that satisfies the descent. So let's see, let's start with some basics. There's nothing here, this is all due to growth meaning. In fact, in the whole week there may not be anything I'd say which you couldn't find by Googling, if you were a good enough Googler. So let's be a scheme over S. And E is a section, for the closed section of E. Hey, you know, if I insult you by not studying your work, let me know. I'm defined by my deal. All right. When we get a very important shape on E, oh, and I probably won't ever say this again, but Q will be, Q is quasi compact, quasi separated. And I may stop saying that. So now let's define the conormal sheath of this embedding in P. You take I mod I squared, where that's a nice sheath, that's on X. And I really want to sheet my head, so let's pull it back. This is I'll give an example of it. No less much. And define the case into the infinitesimal neighborhood. Okay. This is the closed embedding. Defined by either tables. Okay, so where am I going with this? So for example, if x is equal to, let's take the simplest possible guy. And what's the obvious section? How about setting E to be where X is equal to 0? Then, of course, I is equal to the X. WE is equal to I mod I squared as an A module. Out of an AX model. And XK, let's call this XK so I don't forget the writing. So use it in the power series. All right, and then let's see, let's define a graded ring. This is a graded ring of graded the last one. So in my example, this just looks like this. Is the graded ring associated, or Y is the We have the following picture.
S is equal to x0, this is the mean in x1.
And up here somebody says x, okay? And this all lies over S.
Alright, and I won't give a remark, although I just erased the definition.
Let's see. That would be E is actually equal to, it's the same thing, you don't go all the way to X, but you just consider the inclusion into XK. All that's saying is that if you look at this example, if I take the ideal generated in here by x and divide out by square, I get the same thing as if I went all the way to the big one. Alright, and that the nth piece of x for all k. In short, these things don't depend on x, they just depend on the infinitesimal neighborhood. And only on this ascending chain rather than a not on X. All right. Why is that a good thing? Well, you can generalize it. Well, suppose X is, I can generalize this. Suppose X is more, is less than a scheme, but just a sheaf. I'm going to give you an example in a second. Now, I'm going to write something technical here which you can believe or ignore. This construction, which has two variables, is stable under fallback. So we can still define it. Define xk. Now the definition, I can give you the definition of chair. It's the obvious thing, you pull back the sheaves and you pull back the schemes and restrict them and fill the sheaf out of all that business. But it's, you know, we're taking a little while to write, so let's just believe this. And now I want to write down a definition. This is due to growth in you. There's some question, what was Grothendieck trying to accomplish here? Well, I'm not going to be able to channel Grothendieck, but I think he was trying to grapple with the concept of what does it mean to be smooth in the formal setting. If you look at like the smoothness theorem or something, none of them work out very well when you try to sort of generalize to the formal setting. So this is what they came up with. One possible solution. So we've got this picture. So this here, this is just a sheet. And let's make this a scheme. I didn't put any brick structures in yet. So let's call that a formal lead variety. If the following things happen, first of all, X is actually the union of these infinitesimal neighborhoods. All right, it's a colon. So that means I can get all of X by taking things up from the start. I'll give you an example in a second. secondly, each one of these, which I only defined as only said with a sheet, it's actually a scheme. And let's make it an affine scheme. So if that's the speck of a ring, I mean this is speck of a ring. If it's not speck of a ring, it just means it's local at that point. What else? I have this nice sheet with WE. WE is locally free of finite range. The vector bundle. In our example, it'll be locally free of range 1. And finally, I've got this, let's see, I've got this graded thing. X, and I can take the symmetric algebra over S on this beautiful sheet here, which is locally free of finite rank, and there's a map here because GR1 is equal to definitely a map here, and it claims this. Let's do an extension example.
You mean 1, 2, 3, 4?
Oh, you're worried about your numbers. No, on my notes I have a 0 because I thought of that, but then stuck it first. Alright, so what's your favorite example? Let's let x equal split the power series ring and one generator. So that's our local. So, if P is an A algebra, then X of A, X of B by definition, is equal to the set of A and element of B. That shouldn't make you notes look terrible. Such that A to the K is equal to 0 or something. It's a nil potence. That's what this split means. Okay. All right. Here's my definition. In this case, xk is equal to spec of A x over x of k plus 1. Spec A. And 1 is certainly true by definition. WE is equal to x plus x squared is an A module. That's locally free of finite rank. It's free of rank 1. And let's see what the graded. I already told you the graded star of X, of course, is equal to the graded ring A Y. So this is what I mean by its general star. All right, so let's see. This is true by observation. This is true by construction. 3, and the symmetric algebra on one generator is certainly this. Right. What you get out of this definition is this, right? You have a property which descends. It's like vector bundles. Being free is not a property that behaves well under sin, but being locally free. All right.
I'm curious why we already have the word lead in the
You know, I'm just copying it. You know?
No. Any other people in touch with the history of the subject?
I'm terrible.
You're better at the history of the subject than I am.
It's premature.
What?
To have lead with it.
Yeah.
I think you could just agree over the day, like you said, and saying that the normal bundle of infection is an infinitesimally smooth point.
You buy that?
That's a good excuse for him. Okay. Let me continue this example. If we choose to cover of S by affine, and remember there's an assumption around here which I'm not telling you, spec AI, where this sheet here is free, remember it's locally free, so I can do this, then a local choice of basis defines an isomorphism. This spec over AI. Excellent. I didn't say it was rank one. I said it was finite rank, so that's the end of the rank. So, this is what I mean by things are locally generated. I have to prove this. I'm asserting the 90,000 examples. Someone needs to have to prove it. If you don't want to read it in French, you can look in one of Messing's books. Is that been proven or not? I'll read it in the original, right? So what's a formal group? It's a so a formal Lie group is a group object in formal Lie varieties. Let's write that down. Group object in formal Lie varieties. So, for me, it's a terrible notation, but we're a formal group. It's a commutative. Maybe I'll print that for you. Formal Lie group. Where WE is rank 1. Can you get it fine? I don't think commutative is automatic. No, I don't think so either. And that's, I think I have to assert that. And this guy here, which plays a very important role in the whole theory, this will turn out to be the sheaf of invariant differential. I have to prove you that invariant. Well, maybe I should do better to say isomorphic to the sheaf of invariant. Which I haven't defined or showed as invariant, but I'll get to that. Homomorphisms are what you think they are. I write homomorphisms equal homomorphism, if that makes sense. Or just homomorphism equal homomorphism. I'll change the font a lot. I group object in some category in the homomorphism. Okay, so what's MFG? MFG is equal to the category partnering group length. Over something, over particularly good categories of schemes, which assign so only type of objects. So, S is a scheme. It classifies formal groups. So these are in one-to-one correspondence to formal groups. G over S. And then the morphisms. So if I have a two commuting diagram, G and H are like F. So I need to give you a little picture here. So I've got a formal group over G, a formal group over G, so I can just F star H, G, and then P is an isomorph. Isomorphisms are invertible only. All right, if you want the groupoid over S, each S that assigns the groupoid where objects are formal groups over G and the morphisms are isomorphisms. Formal groups over S. All right, and all of this is very formal. By the way, although I won't prove it, with this definition, it's nearly obvious that MFG is this. This is not to say it's an algebraic stack or anything like that. It just means that it satisfies its effective distinction. Isomorphisms glue. If I have some setup where two things are isomorphic and they have appropriate cocycle conditions, then I can extend it to the union. Like vector
ones. You want to be explicit about the topology here?
In the FPQ sequence. Or anything finer. Of course, sure. Which way does it go? It's true for the eighth hall topology too. Because of course we're fine. Is there is, you know, I could never do that. It's like the left one. So, FPPS, is that a good one? Eighth hall topologies, or SP topology, but certainly true for this one, and that's the one that. All right, so what's good about this one? This is all very formal at this point. There's nothing about one-dimensional here. There's nothing even about, you can do p-divisible groups at this point. Still get a stack and define them if you could do them. So what's special about the one-dimensional one? Why is this a good thing? So let's talk about coordinates. I'm going to let the number I'm up here. 3, 2. And was our. All right, so let's let G, S, so it's got a section, E, Q. This is a formal group. But now I'm at my definition. So in particular, G is this colimit of the infinitesimal neighborhood. So let's let IK, this is, I'll give an example in a second, define the closed inclusion between S and GK, and then the OGP. So what have I done here? If G actually turns out to be equal to something to do with the power series range, an OGE is just simply the ideal generator by practice. What's this funny notation? You're supposed to think of this as the sheaf of functions that vanishes at the identity. Kooky notation. Well, that's a coordinate. Well, I don't have one. So when if you grew up in homotopy theory, the way I did, formal groups always came with coordinates, and it took us years to sort of get over that. The coordinate for G is a global section. X O G E. There it is. Right here. So that following object OS. So global section is always given by a map of sheaves like that. And then I can go on to this quotient G. And this is locally free of rank 1. So it's a coordinate that this is an isomorphism. So, for example, it may not exist. Okay. So I'll get to that in a second. So, in my example, if G is equal to split of A, Y, I guess I should say now, then what are the possible coordinates? Well, there's all the things that generate this thing. And then any coordinate if you have lots. Okay? And that's so the way to say that, so I can, let's make a definition. Let's define coord G over F to be the functor of the scheme action. I have to prove that. Coordinates of G over F. Okay, so that means that that is, if T to S is a morphism of schemes, then I have to tell you the coordinates at G over T to simply equal to the coordinates of F star. Pull it back and then discuss the coordinates. This gives me a functor and turn up. In fact, what is this thing? Well, I may not have a coordinate, but I can always pull it. I can always take a cover where I do have a coordinate, and then I get this many coordinates. So, what's the fancy words for that? Torsion. So the problem is, what is a torsion?
So let me write it down and then we'll start discussing what I have to explain. The coordinate G S is actually an affine coordinate. Why you don't even know? For the group scheme, not a very nice group scheme, but it isn't finite. Lambda R is equal to the unit in R.
search for vacuum expanded model tile spectrum among all simple current orientifolds of all Kepler models, and we found almost 180,000 distinct solutions, not counting hidden factor degrees of freedom. And we also looked thoroughly at that by distribution. So these are all very useful work. I unfortunately can only mention it here and refer to the original work for more details. All right, so in the last 5 minutes then, let me plug this somewhat new result relating to things I've been working on. So he's actually inspired by work by Gomez, Macedano, and Mateos to consider a V4 brain wrapping a V1 equals 0 divisor C with flux F and zero brains bound to it, right? So the supersymmetry condition for this configuration is that F2-0 has to be 0. So this comes from this work. So this is actually, in general, for generic fluxes, well, either this stuff has no solutions, or it just freezes the divisor deformation moduli. So in that sense, it's very similar to the closed string flux vacuum case. Only here, the degrees of freedom are open string degrees of freedom. All right, so skipping some details and assuming you paid close attention in Hiroshi's lecture, what you want to compute? Well, there's several things you can do. I mean, you can use this setup to really just count open string flux vacuum when you, instead of V4 brains, you consider V7 brains, for example. But what I'm going to do here is apply it to counting of microstates, if you want, of the V brain, which then should be compared to what you get from the topological string, if you want, according to this conjecture of a Gruis, Termini, and Vaha. So what they instruct us to do is to compute this partition sum, where omega pq is the number of BPS states, which charges p and q, and you just weigh like this factor. And then while skipping some steps, actually, you can show that the dominant part of this sum at small phi naught is given by these frozen divisors, right, these fluxes. And at the frozen divisor, well, you have just the only degrees of freedom that remain are and the zero brains that can move freely around. This gives a degeneracy that's equal to p chi of n, which is a coefficient of 1 over eta to the chi. The zero brain charge is given by this, and this, very similar to what we had in the closed string case, just picks up the number of solutions of this equation. Okay. All right, so the integral m here is, m here is the divisor deformation moduli space. Okay. So now, using the n equals 1 special geometry of developed by Lerkin, Meyer, and Werner, and again, a small finite approximation, and particularly using techniques developed in Ashok Douglas and I work with Mike, this can be computed to be equal to this thing. So this is the dominant part, if you want. Then there is this coefficient chi hat of m, which is formally just like an order characteristic that's computed with respect to this metric, this Hodge metric. And so this is formally the Euler characteristic, right? But it's a bit subtle because this metric may have singularities, just like in the closed string case. So this is not necessarily equal to the Euler characteristic of some preferred smooth compactification of the moduli space. But the cool thing is that, you know, using these techniques, you get something that is essentially in full agreement with this conjecture of Auguri, Sturm, and Jerome-Vaffa, at least at the perturbative level, at the polynomial level of the p-potential. So this is exactly what you get out of the topological string if you do not consider instanton corrections. Now, actually, you do not expect instanton corrections in this regime because this is a small finite regime, which is, strictly speaking, somewhat out of the range of the original conjecture. because small phi naught is large Q topological, and but in addition to that, incident corrections are extremely suppressed in this limit, so you don't expect to see them in at this level of the approximation. But nevertheless, it is striking that you get some form of the conjecture that actually works for totally general D4, D2, D0 system. So that I think, well, again, shows that even if you don't believe in the aims for which certain techniques are developed, they may, as is often the case in string theory, turn out to be useful for other applications. So that brings me to conclusion, and rather than go over everything again, because well, the whole talk was basically some summary part from this last famous blog of the results, let me simply end with another quote of our grandmaster guru. So, well, this is not from him, of course, so this seems to be the hot question in their need of answer this conference. Is string theory the answer? What is the question? And, well, I wonder the answer to that, but let's bear in mind this thing. Well, if we knew what it was we were doing, it would not be called research, would it? So. All right. So thank you. Okay. One more shameless plug. If you cannot get enough of this stuff, actually, there will be a workshop on string factor and the landscape in Trieste next year, May, June, organized by these people, and you're all very welcome to come and join and have some fun. Okay.
Any questions? Donna. Hi, Frederick, I have a question about how you can use the shameless plug you described at the end. So if you can estimate the numbers of vacua in seven brains with bundles, which is essentially what you just told us, you could probably easily combine your earlier results with Mike with your current shameless plug to estimate numbers of F-theory vacua on fourfolds. So if a typical number was 10 to the 500 in type 2B on an orientifold without those fluxes, what happens in F-theory?
All right, so, yeah, exactly. So you could use this to do these estimates in F-theory, or just more generally any type 2B with seven brains. You can actually do this analysis as well directly in F-theory, where you have actually a unified description of both seven brain moduli and complex structure moduli. They just combine them in the complex structure moduli of the fourfold, and so then you can use the same technique to get some Ashok Douglas-like expression for the number of vacua in that case. Now, naively, if you plug in the numbers, then you get something like 10 to the minus 200, because there's this issue of the sphere in a very high-dimensional space. If the sphere of constant radius is sent to dimension to infinity, you find that the volume actually goes to zero. Now, that just means that this continuum approximation is not very good, but you can sort of improve the estimate by just looking at some subsets of the flux that is and see how what sort of the value of the subdimension, or sorry, the value of the dimension of the sublattice is such that this estimate gets maximized. And using that rough estimate, you can easily get numbers as big as 10 to the 5,000 vacua in F theory. So it's a significant increase. But we have to bear in mind, though, that most of these vacua will have all gauge symmetry broken and so on. So those cuts become very important in that case.
Lenny?
What would you consider a reasonably convincing demonstration
that it's good enough? Right. I asked, what would you consider to be a reasonably convincing demonstration of a vacuum with a positive cosmological constant?
Right.
And how close are we, and what kind of new technology do we need to do that convincingly?
Well, a reasonably convincing argument is, of course, the observation of our own cosmological constant. Well, this depends, I guess, partly also on your belief system at what you want to accept. If you just except four-dimensional effective field theory and what you get out of that, that may be enough for you. But the problem here is you need to get this really out of string theory, and then for dimensional effective field theory might be misleading in the sense that you could, for example, get decay channels through higher KK modes and so on. So, well, probably it will be very hard to find a watertight proof of existence. Maybe through some DSCFT correspondence that may be a good way to go. Otherwise, well, just a more systematic analysis of all possible decay channels and showing that that you know you don't get tachyons in those directions. So that would be at the you know if you want at the classical level would be already a great progress. But,
yeah. Eva.
So I had a slightly more technical question. On the model building side, we find a kind of dichotomy of types of moduli. There are ones that run away and ones that are more or less compact. On the statistical side, can you take that into account, or is that already built into your statistical analyses?
So you mean series of vector that run away to infinite volume?
No, I'm just saying there are things like volumes that run away and things like positions of test frames on a compact space that are basically compact and don't run away, and the form of the potential energy for the two is rather different.
Right.
And is that built into the statistical distributions that
Well, these distributions don't care too much about the global structure of this potential in a particular runaway direction because they're really local computations, so all you need is information about some very small neighborhood of a point, and then you can compute the distribution. So it essentially does not care about possible runaway directions. So at that level, the answer would be no. It doesn't matter.
If you fix the charge of the black hole, which is the same thing as fixing the fluxes, if the charge is large, you have typically some exponentially large degeneracy.
Yeah.
But in your vacuum counting, it seemed that you were assuming for fixed flux there was a degeneracy of one.
Yeah, right. But in this case,
okay,
in this case, the exponential behavior you get. So now you fix. Okay, so you turn on this generic flux, so that will, unless the flux descends from the ambient Calabi-Yau, it will freeze the moduli of the divisor. Now, then you have still these NV0 brains that can move freely on this brain, and so perhaps in the vacuum counting context, maybe you might want to count it as one, but here, clearly, you should not count it as one. You count the Euler characteristic of that component of the moduli space. You still have this n-fold symmetric product of the zero brains, which you know then gets smoothed out to the Hilbert scheme of n points, and it's the contributions of those components, so the Euler characteristic of those components that then eventually give the exponential behavior of the black hole.
Yeah, but I'm not questioning the black hole side. I'm questioning the other side, the assumption that for every fixed fluxes, there's a degeneracy of one.
Oh, all right. Okay. Well, okay. So it depends on your prescription what you want to count. So say that you really wanted to count some quantum microstates, and you had some other prescription than just one for each. Then yeah, that you could take it into account, and but rather easily using the same techniques. So at this point, we just counted, you know, individual critical points. That was the counting problem that we solved. But if you want an additional weighting factor, which of course physically might very well be needed and might be crucial, we can include that and redo the analysis. But at this point,
So your assumption could be off by an exponentially large factor.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, in particular, the that's what's suggested by quantum cosmology and so on. But nevertheless, this will be...